Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, the number 23. As of today, that's how many Democratic candidates are running for president in 2020. The group includes senators, governors, mayors of big cities and small, Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and of course, the former vice president. So, how can a candidate stand out in such a crowded field? How different are their messages? And is this a good or bad thing for the Democratic Party? I asked Josh Crosshart to join me for his perspective. He's the politics editor for the National Journal. Josh, it's good to have you here.
It's good to be on the show, Diane.
23 presidential candidates on the Democratic side. How in the world did we end up with such a huge, and maybe this isn't the end of it, such a huge group of people?
There are two big reasons for why this field is historically large. One is that President Trump looks awfully vulnerable. And whenever you have an incumbent president that looks like he can be defeated, you get more candidates that want to run against him. And the president has never hit 50% in job approval ever since he's been in office. There's a near majority, a 45% base of Democratic and independent voters that are probably going to vote against him no matter what. So that is incentivizing Democrats to take their chance at the presidential lottery rather than maybe to run for the Senate or a governorship or do something else in politics. The other big factor is that the party institutions on both sides, but especially the Democratic side this election year, has gotten a lot weaker. They can't really offer incentives. There are no superdelegates that are going to be affecting the process up until the second ballot in this year's campaign. So it's a much more small D Democratic process. And when Democrats look at how Donald Trump came out of nowhere without any presidential, any political experience, any real experience in government or the military and won the nomination out of nowhere, a lot of Democrats, even small town mayors, low level congressmen, they think, I can do that. If Donald Trump can do it, I can make the big leagues.
So are there any drawbacks to putting yourself out there?
Well, there's a drawback for the Democratic Party, which is that when you have so many candidates running, it's hard for any average voter to know who's in the race, to pay attention to all this chaos. So on one hand, I think that does benefit the brand name candidates, the elected officials that are best known, namely Vice President Joe Biden, but also the runner up in last year's primary campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. They have a built-in brand, for better or for worse, that is going to gravitate a lot of voters towards them at the very beginning, whereas a lot of accomplished but lesser known candidates like a Kamala Harris, the senator from California, or even like a Pete Buttigieg, the mayor from South Bend, who's getting a lot of attention, they have to do a lot more work to catch up to be on that same level.
Now, I gather as you and I are talking today, you talked with Mayor Pete this morning. Give me an idea of your impressions.
So Mayor Pete was at the Washington Post doing an interview. And the thing with Pete Buttigieg is that he's one of the most authentic candidates running. That when you talk to him in person, I had coffee with him a few months ago. And what you heard from Mayor Pete in that small coffee shop is the same as what you hear from him on the campaign
trail. Give me an example of what you find so authentic.
Well, he can speak about policy, about values, about his personal life and his impressive story. He's a small town mayor, but he also served in the military. He came out. He's one of the few openly gay candidates ever to run for president. And he offers the kind of detail, the kind of personal experience that most candidates speak about in talking points. They have a line and they keep on repeating it. Whereas Mayor Pete is much more, he says things off the cuff. He can speak in depth about a whole host of issues without having to resort to talking points.
So he is one of 23 that CNN and also MSNBC have been having these forums with. How have they gone over? How have people responded to their one-hour events. So giving people a good sense of who these folks are.
These town halls, which all the three major cable networks have sponsored, are the most important thing that these candidates can do in the early stages of the race. It used to be you would camp out in Iowa or New Hampshire and you know, making an impression with those early voting states would be the most not consequential thing. And it still is. It still matters. But especially with candidates looking to get their profile raised, going in front of 1 million, 2 million people on CNN, Bernie Sanders went on Fox News, got the highest audience that they've had for any town hall event. You know, MSNBC has had a bunch of candidates also on their air. That you're getting millions of people in front of you. And this race is increasingly a national contest more than an early state contest. So Iowa's caucuses, New Hampshire's primary, they're still going to be very important.
Sure.
At weeding out the 23 candidates. But if you don't get known, if people don't know who you are, you're going to not get attention in Iowa or New Hampshire or anywhere else. So these town hall events have become sort of the new debates. This is the first chance for these candidates to get on the big stage.
And you've just used the word I want to talk about, which is debates. How are they going to happen with 23 candidates?
It's a very convoluted process that Democrats have been worried about. The Democratic National Committee had to come up with a set of rules to manage such an unruly presentation. So what the DNC decided to do is that you had to get at least 65,000 individual donors to your campaign, or you had to register at least 1% in a serious polls that have been taken before that debate takes place. But even with that, there are going to be 20 candidates on stage, and they're going to be randomly selected on two different nights. So you'll have 10 candidates on the stage one night. The next night, you'll have the other 10 candidates. It's going to be hard for any one candidate to get any face time. You're literally talking about an hour, 2 hours of debate split up between those 10 candidates. So it's going to be really hard for any one candidate to really break out, given how crowded that debate stage is going to be.
And have the moderators been chosen?
They have, or at least the networks have been chosen. So I believe MSNBC is holding the first debate in the end of June in Florida. And then CNN is having the next debate in July. So they're going to be a bunch of early debates with a crowded field. The big controversy, of course, is that DNC Chairman Tom Perez decided not to allow Fox News to host any of these debates, even though they've been hosting town halls with many of the leading Democratic candidates.
Does that make sense in your view?
It's a controversial decision even among Democrats, because there are a lot of Fox viewers that are going to be voting in really important swing states.
Of course.
These are not all hardcore Republicans. There are many undecided voters that watch Fox News, and to deliberately leave your candidates off that highly watched channel, it's the highest rated channel on cable news right now. I think there's a little bit of self-destructive behavior in the decision to do that. And there's a reason why a lot of candidates, including Bernie Sanders, decided to go on Fox News, and he was rewarded with a very warm audience reception and a record high rating from Fox News.
So you said 20 of the 23 will make it. Do you know who those three eliminated will be?
I feel like this will be a game of musical chairs.
Yeah.
Because if you have 23 candidates that get 1% at some point in the polls, and they get enough donors, you're going to have the DNC having to choose who's not going to make that debate stage. But look, it creates a whole host of logistical nightmares when you have such a big field for the party, because not only will the DNC possibly have to vote someone off the debate island, if you will, but they're also going to have to play favorites in a way that they like to stay neutral in the whole process.
But, Josh, even before we get to the debates, wouldn't some of those candidates sort of realize, you know, maybe I can't go this far?
Fundraising is going to be the big challenge for a lot of candidates, because, of course, in order to have a presidential campaign, you need to pay staff. You need to pay your consultants, your pollsters, your media people. And there are a lot of candidates that have high expectations. They're hiring a bunch of expensive, big name talent. And if they don't get any traction early on, they may not get enough money into their campaigns to pay the bills.
So after Joe Biden, who's got the most money?
So in terms of the first quarter, the first 3 months of fundraising, Biden was in the lead. But Bernie Sanders very, very close behind. And then you've got folks like Senator Kamala Harris, who raised a pretty healthy total, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who wasn't even in the race for that whole period, but he captured the hearts and imaginations of a lot of Democratic voters. And we've seen that money come in as his poll numbers have also gone up.
I'm wondering, you said it's going to be very hard for 10 and 10 candidates to get up there and make their points. How much do you think those debates are going to matter?
I think we're not going to see as dramatic an effect from the early Democratic debates as we saw in 2016 when Donald Trump really dominated the stage and everything was about either challenging Trump or trying to make a name for yourself. The Democrats are going to, I mean, there's a real risk if you're a lesser known candidate who tries to take on a Joe Biden, because usually what you see in politics when you have this big field, when someone who's an underdog takes on the front runner, both of them get hurt. But if you're a lesser known candidate, you don't want to marginalize your own campaign at the expense of taking on Biden. You're going to want to wait and see how this field develops. You're going to want to get some traction in Iowa and New Hampshire before you really go on the attack. So my expectation is a lot of the Democrats on those early debate stages are going to be cautious. They're going to be trying to promote themselves. And maybe aside from Bernie Sanders, if he's on the same debate stage, I don't see a lot of the other candidates really trying to make a fight early on against Vice President Biden.
And how is Biden going to behave on that stage?
Well, Biden is acting like a front runner. He's not had quite as busy of a campaign schedule in his first month or two on the campaign trail. He's acting like a front runner. He's acting like a disciplined candidate than more than we've seen in recent years. But he, you know, they're sending pool reports. His campaign is like you get from the White House. That's what a front runner does when you have an operation that's well funded, well organized. They're treating him like a front runner, like a very formidable candidate. I mean, my bigger question with Biden is, does he have the energy? Does he have the stamina to really, you know, fight at age 76? A very rigorous process, this campaign trail.
And how do you answer your own question?
I think we have to wait and see. I will say that Joe Biden is running a very smart campaign. His argument in this race is that he's most electable, and Democrats seem to be buying into that message. I think Biden, you know, he's ended up being his own worst enemy in the past. If he can just stay the course and not make any major mistakes, he's got a strong advantage.
I wonder who his faux debating partner is going to be.
Bernie Sanders. I think with Biden and Sanders, you're looking at the two ideological wings of the Democratic Party. You have Joe Biden, who's somewhat of a pragmatist, who has a long record of accomplishment as a senator, vice president, against a revolutionary, as someone who describes himself as a socialist in Bernie Sanders. And both have strong support. Joe Biden actually has deeper support than I think a lot of people realized. He's polling at about 35% to 40%. African-American voters view him very favorably. And his ties to President Obama mean a lot to the African-American community. And I think that will be a very important dynamic. Sanders has a base, too, of people who view the Obama years as too milquetoast, as not revolutionary enough. There's a growing outspokenness among progressives in the Democratic Party. And they are looking at Bernie Sanders, also Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, as a more progressive alternative.
It really is going to be something to see how many women on the stage and how many men?
More women than we've ever seen before.
In a way,
that there's not one woman that like Hillary Clinton we're folks can coalesce behind. So, you know, Kamala Harris is a very formidable candidate, former Attorney General of California, only the second African American woman ever to serve in the Senate. She's going to be have a big impact. Elizabeth Warren certainly is gaining ground by talking about policies that she favors, and she's really distinguished herself by offering more details than many of the other candidates. And I wouldn't rule out Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who really made a name for herself during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. She's spent a lot of her early time in Iowa, which is neighboring to her home state of Minnesota. She's a moderate, she's a pragmatist, and she knows how to get things done. And that may be, if Biden doesn't maintain his lead, Klobuchar would be an appealing alternative to many moderate voters.
You've written that having this huge Democratic field is not necessarily good for Democrats or for voters. How come?
Well, it doesn't give Democrats the full opportunity to sample the alternatives. And there's a famous book that posited that the when you have too many choices, you have less choice. You become overwhelmed with all the choices that are out there. And voters or consumers even tend to default to the front runner or tend to default to the best known candidate. So you have 270-something-year-olds in Sanders and Biden that are in the lead largely because they're better known than their opponents. But that lead may be more lasting than people think, just because it's going to be hard for voters, even in Iowa and New Hampshire, to sample all these different candidates, each of whom bring different things to the table. So Biden has this lead that he can, this 20, 30-point lead in some polls, that he can hang on to simply because it's going to be hard for voters to differentiate all the different candidates out there.
So how quickly would you see the number of candidates diminish?
The role that Iowa plays and also New Hampshire is that they've pare down the field. If you're not registering, you're not finishing in the top four or five out of Iowa, you're probably going to have to think about dropping out of the race.
So when does Iowa take place? So
we're talking February of 2020.
February of 2020. And when does the first debate take place?
That's taking place. It's hard to believe. It's just next month.
I know. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, well, we do. I mean, as a political reporter, we feel like every day there's always something going on in the world of politics, but it really is pretty remarkable that we're only 8 months away from the first caucuses and primaries.
And when you think about how long it's going to take voters to wade through the promises, the policies, the differences among these people, really hard. Don't you wonder whether people make up their minds even before those debates happen?
In some cases, they do. And in many cases, they're not voting based on policies. I mean, that was a lesson that Hillary Clinton, I think, learned the hard way. She had the most detailed policies, both in the primary and she ran against Obama as well. And it didn't pay off for her. Voters, I think, know that they have a certain ideological profile of who they're looking for. So I think there's a clear difference between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. People who are more moderate are more likely to gravitate towards the former vice president. People who are more progressive are looking at Sanders and Warren. But look, a lot of candidates really haven't fleshed out policies yet. In fact, you have Harris, who's talking about gender equity on the campaign trail this month. She's trying to actually move a little more to the left than I think folks expected. But every candidate is going to have to try to appeal to a certain niche of voters. And that decision and how they try to strategize their campaigns to appeal to a narrow slice of the electorate is going to go a long way to deciding who wins and who's successful.
I also find myself even thinking forward to a debate between President Trump and whoever the Democratic candidate might be. And if it were Joe Biden, how would you see that going?
You have two candidates, white males in their mid-70s. I mean, these would be the two oldest presidential nominees in our modern history, if not all of American history. So you would have two big egos going at each other. One thing that Biden has done to great success early on is that he's made his campaign about taking on President Trump. He has not avoided talking about Donald Trump on the campaign trail. In his opening campaign video, he invoked the Charlottesville, the neo-Nazis marching in Charlottesville and saying how Trump is so out of the mainstream. That's been a major part of his message. Trump has actually been baited into responding to the former vice president. And that's what Joe Biden wants. He wants to be seen as the strongest, most electable Democrat in that big field. And he wants to be seen as the person who can really take the fight to President Trump.
Now, hasn't Joe Biden gotten something of a reputation of speaking off the cuff when he shouldn't have? Exactly as President Trump has.
He has. His political history when running for president has been underwhelming, to say the least. He ran for president in 1988 when he was one of the younger candidates in the field and ended up having to drop out because of accusations of plagiarism. He ran against President Obama, Hillary Clinton in 2008. And while he had a few good moments on the debate stage that year, he just got very, very little support. But he's been Obama's he was vice president for a popular Democratic president for 8 years. He has a lot of goodwill within the Democratic Party. And I'll tell you, Diane, because of Donald Trump, because of his propensity to say all kinds of wild things, the weaknesses of Joe Biden don't seem as big of a deal as they did in the past. I think the gaffes that Biden will make, and he already has a few stumbles, but I don't think they mean as much in our 24/7 world where we scrutinize everything that Trump says. And it seems like the mistakes Biden has made pales in comparison.
Now a quick break. When I come back, more of my conversation with Josh Kraushauer.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Josh Kraushauer. He's the politics editor at the National Journal. There's this big debate on Capitol Hill, Nancy Pelosi trying to hold back those who want to move ahead with impeachment. Should that impeachment process begin to move forward? How do you think that could affect all these Democrats?
It's a very risky decision for the speaker because she knows as well as anyone that she became speaker because a lot of these moderate Democratic candidates who won elections in the House did not talk about President Trump. They did not talk about impeachment. They didn't even really talk about the Mueller report before it was released. And she knows that voters, even the most liberal voters, care more about economic policy, healthcare policy. They don't even follow the really messy details of the subpoena fights and all the legislative and executive branch fights over the Mueller report. So it's a tricky situation. I think on one hand, Democrats do want Trump's sort of chaotic governance in his first few years to be a big part of the election. It's sort of well known that Trump has a unique and divisive way of governing. But I think the way Democrats won the House and how they'll win the presidency is by focusing on policies that voters prefer. And what Pelosi is worried about is that no one in the media is talking about the legislation that Democrats in the House have passed. They passed a big campaign finance reform legislation that's not going anywhere. But she would love to see the news media talking about it a lot more. Instead, they're talking about the fights between Jerry Nadler and the White House, about all these subpoenas. Voters have tuned that out by and large, and Democrats aren't getting a whole lot of political advantage by seeing that on the news.
So do you think those on the far left will begin to understand that Nancy Pelosi has it right?
Well, they respect Pelosi's leadership, but they disagree wholeheartedly on her cautiousness on impeachment. But Pelosi, she made an amusing comment the other day about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the better known progressives in her caucus. She said, you know, Ocasio-Cortez, a water bottle could have beaten a Republican in her district. There are a lot of Democrats that are going to be in very competitive races who could lose if there's too much of a focus on impeachment. And there was an NBC Wall Street Journal poll that was just conducted this month that showed only 14% of Americans wanted impeachment proceedings to go forward. There was another 33% or so that wanted investigations and they wanted to see hearings, but didn't want to go as far as impeachment. But you still have almost half the country that doesn't even want investigations, any more investigations of this administration.
Even with the tax reports that are likely to come out within maybe the next couple of months?
Even with all the scandal. And that we're a divided country and a very tribal and partisan country right now. So, you know, you do have half the country that is defending Trump almost at all costs. And you have half the country that opposes him. But within that half that opposes him, it's split between whether impeachment should go forward or whether there should be a much more cautious and deliberate process.
So when we think about a cautious and deliberate process, does that mean that Nadler's committee should stop what it's doing or be more quiet about what it's doing?
I've talked to a lot of leading Democratic political strategists who think that the best outcome for Democrats is having someone like Robert Mueller testify. You know, a lot of people didn't read the Mueller report, but when you put him on camera and have him talk about the details, the unfavorable details pertaining to the White House, it will have a bigger political impact and it could actually play quite a bit to the Democrats' favor. The challenge is when they get into this nitty gritty over, you know, who's going to testify, whether we need to have subpoenas over time. I think people get lost in all the details. The top strategists I've talked to think that Democrats should remain aggressive in prosecuting the case against Trump on vis-a-vis the Mueller report, but they shouldn't get bogged down into a lot of these messy details.
Do you think Mueller will testify?
According to some recent news reports, Mueller doesn't want to publicly testify.
I know.
He doesn't want to make this a political moment.
He said behind closed doors he might be willing.
More willing to do so privately, which is not what Democrats want. They want the headlines.
The cameras.
They want the cameras.
Absolutely.
They want the sound bites. So it's actually quite fascinating because as supportive as Democrats have been towards Robert Mueller, they're putting a lot of pressure on him to deliver some political goods their way. And he is not playing ball.
Let's see how this might work. That Mueller would agree to give a certain part of testimony before cameras and another part behind closed doors.
That's possible, but reading between the lines, it seems like his biggest concern is he doesn't want anything to be used. He doesn't want any of his testimony to be used and to be televised in a political forum. So I really the fact that we're still into May and we haven't seen any date scheduled for Mueller to testify, it shows that he is deeply hesitant about stepping forward.
All right, let's go back to who is going to be a front runner and who's not. Are the media's front runners the same as those of voters right now?
I think largely so. Biden and Bernie Sanders, by virtue of their high profiles, are certainly in that first tier of candidates. We at National Journal, we actually put together a list of our top 10, but we concluded that there are really eight candidates that we could see as winning the nomination in our estimation. So we have Biden and Sanders at the top, but we also put Kamala Harris near the top of the list, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts near the top, and also in varying order, Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Amy Klobuchar, and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Those eight are the most plausible candidates in our estimation.
And do you think that the people feel the same way you do?
Let's hope so. But the polls do generally. I mean, and look, Buttigieg was no one knew who he was a couple months ago, and he zoomed into fourth place in many polls. So it is sometimes foolhardy to make predictions. But each of these candidates also has potential. They've shown the ability to get headlines. They have a esteemed office, senator, governor. They're charismatic in many cases. So these candidates aren't just registering in the polls, but they've shown some degree of organization. They've been able to demonstrate that they're plausible national candidates.
So is it issues or is it personality?
It's both, but personality is playing a larger and larger role in our politics, especially in our Trump era, and especially with social media. You know, all it takes is a 10-second viral moment for a candidate who few people hadn't heard of to become a brand name. To some extent, we saw that with Beto O'Rourke in Texas. This was a backbench congressman who wasn't very distinguished in the House, decided to run for the Senate, ran an excellent campaign, came very close to defeating Ted Cruz, and all of a sudden he was considered the hot candidate for a long while. His stock has faded a little bit in recent weeks, but in today's social media-fueled politics, any one of the 23 candidates can have a moment and all of a sudden find themselves becoming a political celebrity.
Josh, another thing you pointed out is that with all these Democratic candidates putting themselves forward, the Senate itself could suffer. Talk about that.
There are a number of long-shot presidential candidates who probably will never become the nominee, probably won't even make a big impact in the race, that decided to pass up a very winnable and very important Senate race that could help Democrats retake the Senate majority instead of taking this long shot presidential risk. So John Hickenlooper, the governor of Colorado, he's someone who probably would be the favored candidate against Cory Gardner in this really important Colorado Senate race. Steve Bullock, who was one of the last candidates to announce his presidential campaign. He's the governor of Montana. He's the only Democrat that probably could put a red state like Montana into play. He decided not to go for the Senate. He decided to run for president instead. And then you have some lesser known candidates, or Stacey Abrams in Georgia, who's not running for, we don't think she hasn't announced a presidential campaign yet, but she also decided not to run for the Senate.
So you think that really, Democrats could have used these people far more effectively running for the Senate.
They have a very long shot to win the presidency. They'd have a very good shot to win some must-win Senate Senate races. And it's important because, let's say, you know, Bernie Sanders becomes president. Well, even his most progressive agenda probably wouldn't have a lot of chance of passing if Democrats can't take back the Senate. If Democrats can't take back the Senate, frankly, even a deal maker like Joe Biden would have trouble getting a lot of legislation passed. So Mitch McConnell has been the great resistor. He's been very effective at you know, squelching the best laid plans
of
Democrats.
He's up for election this year as well.
He is in Kentucky, and he's always had some concern, especially on his right flank. Ironically, a lot of very conservative voters don't have as much support for him as a lot of the rank and file Republicans. But given how Republican Kentucky has become, given how favorably President Trump is viewed in Kentucky, McConnell is likely going to have a good chance of winning.
Josh, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Diane.
That's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urev-Lifker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.